Ken Mellman strongly defended my honor and integrity in talk show appearances, as Dan Bartlett did on CNN. But my most credible defenders were the same well-known White House correspondents who had pounded me that week of the Roe revelation and later the week of the Libby indictment. And they were credible because they were not spinning or obfuscating for partisan purposes, but simply expressing what they knew to be true. For example, during an appearance on Hardball with Chris Matthews on October 31, 2005, David Gregory, the chief White House correspondent for NBC News, and my toughest, least courteous nemesis in the briefing room, was asked about my position. It was the Monday following Fitzgerald's single indictment in the investigation, with Fitzgerald continuing to investigate Carl's role as I continued my defensive no-comment posture at the podium about the whole affair. "It gets kind of hot in that briefing room, doesn't it, these days?" Matthews asked Gregory. "It can, and it does, certainly when it has to do with Scott McClellan's statements about these individuals not being involved in any way, shape, or form," Gregory said. Then he added, "I mean, Scott is in a tough position. We understand that because he's being told, as are all White House employees, by the White House counsel, Harriet Myers, by the way, not to talk about any of this. But the reality is that he made a public statement about getting assurances directly from Karl Rove and Scooter Libby that they were not involved with any of this, and that was not the case. Because even if it is not a crime, and we know that Scooter Libby has been accused of committing a crime of obstruction of justice and perjury, Karl Rove has not been accused of any crime. They were indeed involved in conversations about a covert officer of the CIA. And you don't have to believe me, that's what Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald said of Plame's classification. So that's the spot that he's in. And it's a question of credibility. And Scott said to us, look, you, the members of the press corps, know me. I'm a credible guy. That's true. He has a sterling reputation. But it's a question for the American people, you know. It's a real question if you say something that turns out not to be true. The previous day on CNN's Reliable Sources with Washington Post media reporter Howard Kurtz, CBS's John Roberts had come to my defense. John Roberts, do you believe that Scott McClellan owes the press and the public an apology for his, what turned out to be misleading denial in the CIA leak case? Kurtz asked. Well, you know, Howie, I may be one of the people in the minority, but I think that he's getting a really rough deal on this, Roberts said. You know, he doesn't go out and freelance this stuff. He goes out there and he tries to faithfully articulate whatever it is that the White House tells him. Obviously, in October of 2003, he got some pretty bad information. Is it his fault that he conveyed that information? I don't think so. I think the people who are at fault are, the ones at fault are the ones who gave him what now appears to be bad information. So I think that Scott, you know, I've known him for a number of years now. I've got a pretty good working relationship with him. I think that he is a truth teller. I think he is a stand-up guy. And I just think he was just told to carry somebody else's water, and it just turned out that that water was foul. On the same day, in a roundtable appearance on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Terry Moran, ABC's chief White House correspondent, also defended my reputation with his candor. What does the White House do now about their press secretary, Scott McClellan, and the fact, on occasion after occasion after occasion, he had absolute blanket denials? There was no involvement by Rove, no involvement by Libby, Stephanopoulos asked. It's an incredibly difficult position to put the press secretary in, Moran responded. I was in the room. He was telling falsehoods right at us over and over unwittingly. But do you think he knew? Panelist Cokie Roberts inquired. No, said Moran, and he signaled that he wants to tell us the story, he added, referring to my sincere comments at the podium that I would like nothing more than to be able to talk about events surrounding my public exoneration of Rove and Libby. I got to press this then, Stephanopoulos said. Okay, you say he didn't know it, so that means that Karl Rove lied to him. Yes, Moran said, yes. What does the president do about that? Stephanopoulos asked. He's got to do something, Moran said, before correctly predicting the continued awful communication strategy of stonewalling. My sense is right now, they'll kick this down the road. They'll say it's a continuing criminal case, and we're going to kick it down the road. We had a presidency just recently where the president lied to his press secretary and everybody else in the White House, Roberts added in reference to Bill Clinton. But what does the president do? Stephanopoulos pressed. George Will jumped in. At this point, change the subject, he said. It's an old axiom in politics. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own, as he correctly suggested the president would do by naming a new Supreme Court nominee following Harriet Meyer's withdrawal just days earlier. The president nominated Sam Alito to the bench the very next morning, but that did nothing to alleviate my painful humiliation or ward off the continued blows to the credibility of the Bush administration. In an interview with Republican Party Chairman Mehlman, John King of CNN said, "You call Scott McClellan a good man. I agree with you. A little dangerous for me. I'm supposed to be objective here. He is a good guy. He has one of the toughest jobs in Washington. I've been in that briefing room during questions like this in this administration, questions like this in the Clinton administration. He has, if you watch, fairly or unfairly, suffered some damage in that room. His credibility is at question with the people who cover the president every day because of this." King then asked Mehlman, "So you're essentially saying that it is a fair price, Scott McClellan, a man who has been loyal to this president back to his days as governor of Texas, his credibility is a fair price to defend Karl Rove? What I'm saying is that Scott McClellan and Karl Rove and George W. Bush are less worried about personal credibility than they are about a process," Mehlman said. "They want to get to the bottom of this. They want to make sure that justice gets done. And the way justice gets done is not to have the White House and president making comments from the podium about an investigation of the White House. And so I think what he is doing is, frankly, very admirable. And I think the fact that he's willing to put himself second and put the process first is exactly what we talk about when we say somebody who's coming to Washington to serve rather than worry about themselves." Clinging to the candid words from my briefing room inquisitors, I deceived myself further by thinking my reputation and credibility with the press could survive in the absence of an honest, personal explanation, which I was prevented from making because I went along with directions not to comment. In hindsight, the strong relationship of trust that I had established with the White House press corps could do little except permit a badly wounded spokesman and his damaged credibility to survive the next several months. And just barely. There's only one moment during the leak episode that I'm reluctant to discuss. However, since I'm committed to telling the truth as I know it, and since the moment seems to be of some relevance given its timing and nature, I feel that full disclosure is the only option. It was in 2005, during a time when attention was focusing on Rove and Libby, and it sticks vividly in my mind. I don't recollect the exact day, but it was following a staff meeting in Andy Card's office. He shared a two-office suite. Three staff assistants worked in a common area that connected the two offices and served as a waiting area and entrance to both. The second office was for the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, who at the time was Karl Rove. The meeting in Andy's office included some principals, or assistants to the president, and some deputies, or deputy assistants to the president. I believe some special assistants were also in attendance. Following the meeting, some of us, maybe a handful, we're still working our way out the door of the suite's common area and mingling at its entryway, near the door to Carl's office and in front of his able assistant, Taylor Hughes's desk. Scooter Libby was walking to the entryway as he prepared to depart when Carl turned to get his attention. "You have time to visit?" Carl asked. "Yeah," replied Libby. They were just a few feet from me before they disappeared behind the closing door to Carl's office. I have no idea what they discussed, but it seemed suspicious for these two, whom I had never noticed spending any one-on-one time together, to go behind closed doors and visit privately. Carl's office door was always open unless there was a real need for privacy. It was not unusual for me to stick my head in his door and briefly interrupt. Carl always tended to be busy working on countless issues, events, or plans. If I needed to get information from him to prepare for the press briefing, information I always had to obtain under time constraints, the easiest way was to just go to him. Why would I remember this moment so vividly? Because these are the two colleagues, one a fellow Texan, I put my credibility on the line to defend. The two who assured me, unequivocally, they were not involved in leaking the identity of Valerie Plame. At least one of them, Rove, it was publicly known by that time, had at best misled me by not sharing relevant information. And credible rumors were spreading that the other, Libby, had done at least as much. The confidential meeting also occurred at a moment when I was being battered by the press for publicly vouching for the two by claiming they were not involved in leaking Plame's identity, when recently revealed information was now indicating otherwise. In the 4 years we had all worked together at the White House, I had never seen the two meet one-on-one. Now, here they were meeting privately behind closed doors late in the game when both were under investigation and intensifying public scrutiny. I do not know what was discussed. But what would any knowledgeable person reasonably and logically conclude was the topic? Like the whole truth of people's involvement, we will likely never know with any degree of confidence. A growing sense of burnout led me to briefly consider resigning, but I never felt the president himself had knowingly misled me or withheld relevant information from me. And despite some uncertainties from within about the course we were on, I remained determined to honor my commitment to him without appreciating how difficult it would be. I imagine some believe my resignation at that moment could have helped the president. Maybe so. But it was Bush's unconscious acquiescence and, at times, enabling of deception that put us in such a precarious position. It would continue plaguing his presidency and his standing with the public, instead of embracing openness and forthrightness to prevent the scandal from taking hold. He allowed suspicion to grow and partisan warfare to flourish. More than 30 years later, Nixon's legacy of the permanent scandal culture was bedeviling yet another president who'd failed to learn the lessons of Watergate. I certainly paid a price as a result, but a far greater price was paid by the Bush administration and by the nation it was pledged to serve.